Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 115.
To help you orient yourself in this incredibly rich world, we need to carefully set the stage first.
Yeah, we are dropping you right into the epicenter of a decaying aristocratic dynasty in 18th century China. This is the Jia family. So we open the chapter in the study room.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so crucial to understand that the study room in this context is not like a cozy library where you read for pleasure.
No armchairs and hot tea here.
No, not at all. The study room is the epicenter of patriarchal authority, is the manufacturing floor of family's future.
And our main protagonist, Jia Baiyu, is currently trapped in this room.
Right.
Now, Baiyu is a deeply sensitive, highly poetic, thoroughly unconventional young man. He is fundamentally allergic to the bureaucratic ambitions of his family.
He hates it.
He really does. But right now, the family is in mourning for a deceased relative, which means Baiyu cannot go to his regular school. He's confined to the family compound.
And his father, Jia Zhang, basically corners him in the study.
It's terrifying. He looks at his son and says, "Since you are home, you need to be reviewing your essays."
And then he just drops a massive anvil on the kid.
He threatens to test Baiyu in a few days to see if he has, quote, made progress. And Jia Zhang doesn't just leave it at, you know, do your homework. He explicitly, surgically pits Baiyu against his own family members. He tells Baiyu, "I have instructed your younger brother Huan and your young nephew Lan to study as well.
Yeah.
If your essays are worse than theirs, do not expect any mercy from me." And the text notes that Baiyu is absolutely terrified. He just replies yes and stands there completely frozen.
It's a profound state of paralysis. I mean, the psychological literature on this is quite clear. When faced with an inescapable, overwhelming threat, the nervous system bypasses fight or flight.
It goes straight into freeze.
Exactly. He is a deer in the headlights of his own family's legacy. Later, when an important guest arrives, we get this incredible detail about the physical positioning in the room. Jia Zhang, the older patriarch, chooses to sit on a cushion on the floor.
Because he wants to show extreme deference to this younger guest.
Yes, performative deference. But the mechanics of social hierarchy dictate that a son cannot be physically elevated above his father.
So because the dad is on the floor?
Precisely. Because the father has chosen the floor, Baiyu and the nephews are physically forbidden from sitting in chairs.
That is wild.
Furthermore, because they are younger than the guest, they cannot share the floor cushions with the guest.
So they literally have nowhere to go.
They are left with absolutely no sanctioned place to exist in that room. They simply have to stand there frozen for the entire duration of the visit.
Which makes the physical layout of the room an exact, terrifying mirror of the psychological layout of their world.
Yes, perfectly stated.
There is literally no comfortable place for you to exist without violating a core structural tenet of your society. Everyone has a highly designated, meticulously engineered spot.
And if you step one inch out of it,
the entire social fabric threatens to unravel.
And that is why Jia Zhang's pragmatism is so lethal. It leaves no room for human variance. It leaves no room for grief, for poetry, for psychological distress.
You either fit the mold or you are a threat to the survival of the unit.
Exactly.
You know, when you lay out the mechanics of it like that, it makes Baiyu's internal crisis so deeply relatable. Because honestly, we still do this to ourselves today.
But without a doubt.
The architecture of utilitarian worth is everywhere. Think about how often we measure our own progress using metrics that are entirely disconnected from our emotional reality.
We track our salaries, our quarter over quarter growth,
our algorithmic reach, and we completely ignore the fact that internally we are frozen, terrified, and grieving. We internalize the strict patriarch.
We become our own Jia Zhang.
Yes, constantly threatening ourselves with our own inadequacy if we don't outproduce our peers.
And when the external world is that hostile, when the pressure to produce is that suffocating, human nature dictates that you look for an escape route.
You have to find a way out.
If you cannot change the external environment, you frantically search for someone who shares your internal reality. You look for a mirror.
Which brings us to one of the most conceptually fascinating narrative pivots I have ever read. Because Baiyu is drowning under this male expectation of bureaucratic success.
He is completely underwater.
His father doesn't understand him. The society rejects his poetic nature. He desperately needs psychological salvation. He needs to know he isn't crazy.
Right.
And if the outside world won't validate him, surely his literal exact doppelganger will.
We move from the crushing external reality of the study room into the deeply internal, almost mythic hope for a soulmate.
Right. So this guest arrives at the compound. His name is Zhen Baiyu. And the universe is playing a massive, almost cruel trick here because Zhen Baiyu looks perfectly, exactly like our protagonist, Jia Baoyu.
It's uncanny.
They share the same name. They have the exact same face. They are the same age. It's a glitch in the Matrix. And Jia Baoyu, our protagonist, has been hyping this meeting up in his head for months.
He really has.
He has completely romanticized what this encounter is going to be.
We have to look at the specific language Baoyu uses to describe his anticipation. He doesn't just think this guy will be a good friend. He believes Zhen Baoyu is a soulmate bound to him by the Three Lives Stone.
Let's explain that, because that term carries a lot of weight. For our listeners, what is the Three Lives Stone?
In Chinese mythology and Buddhist tradition, the Three Lives Stone represents a profound karmic bond that stretches across past, present, and future incarnations.
So it's not just, oh, we have a lot in common.
No, it is the ultimate assertion of destiny. By invoking this, Baoyu isn't just saying we have similar personalities. He is claiming that they are cosmically, inextricably linked by the universe itself.
He is projecting all of his desperate hopes for rebellion onto this mirror image of himself.
Yes, for understanding, for shared rejection of the patriarchal machine.
He's essentially thinking, finally, a lifeboat. Someone who gets it. Someone who isn't obsessed with exams, money, and status.
Exactly.
So they finally meet. And Jia Baoyu opens the conversation with incredibly high praise. He is fully expecting a dialogue that transcends the mundane, vulgar reality of their daily lives.
The text uses this incredible phrase here.
Yes. Baoyu wants to use this conversation to cleanse his secular intestines.
It is a remarkably visceral metaphor.
Cleanse his secular intestines.
The secular world, the world of exams, of political maneuvering, of financial anxiety, is literally framed as a toxin that he has ingested.
It's poisoning him.
And he views this conversation with his cosmic twin as a purge. He wants to wash away the taint of the study room.
He wants to discuss art, emotion, poetry, the transcendent, non-utilitarian things that actually make life worth living for him.
But then the mirror shatters.
Oh man, it is so painful to read.
Because Zhen Baoyu, the much-anticipated doppelganger, finally opens his mouth. And instead of offering a lifeline, he delivers a crushing, perfectly sanitized, deeply corporate monologue about the virtues of conformity.
Here's where it gets really interesting. And devastating. Zhen Baoyu basically looks at our poetic, desperate protagonist and says with complete sincerity, he says, you know, when I was younger, I used to hate all those old cliches too. I hated the rules. I thought I was different.
But then I grew up.
Right. He says, I had to take over the family duties. I started networking with important men. And I realized that the ultimate goal of life is to write essays about loyalty and filial piety.
To build a solid moral and political legacy.
And to ensure you don't waste the wealth and upbringing your parents provided.
He recites the exact doctrine of Jia Zhang. He has internalized the father.
And to make it infinitely worse, young Jialan, our protagonist's little nephew, who is sitting right there in the room, chimes in.
Oh, the nephew.
He enthusiastically agrees with the doppelganger. This child confidently states that practical experience in the real world is 100 times more valuable than poetic talent.
This is the exact moment the realization hits our protagonist. Jia Baoyu is watching his cosmic twin, his supposed spiritual sanctuary, reveal himself to be nothing more than a career worm.
A career worm. The terminology here is incredible. Explain that term.
The term in the original text is Lu Du. Lu refers to official salary or rank. And Du refers to a bookworm or a destructive insect.
A destructive insect? Wow.
Yeah. It translates literally to a merit monger or a worm that blindly feeds on the system of official salary and rank without any deeper moral or intellectual engagement.
It is a devastating philosophical insult. But the psychological trauma here is vastly deeper than just meeting a disappointing hero, right? Because this idol wears his own face.
Yes.
And in this moment, the profound isolation of our protagonist, Jia Baoyu, becomes absolute. He looks at his doppelganger spouting bureaucratic talking points. He looks at his young nephew sounding like a middle-aged middle manager.
He is entirely surrounded.
He is the only person left who rejects this utilitarian nightmare. Everyone else is bought into the illusion.
And we immediately see how the societal machinery rewards that buy-in. This is a crucial mechanical aspect of the narrative.
Right. The society instantly recognizes and commodifies Zhen Baoyu's conformity. Lady Wang immediately springs into action.
The matriarch of the family, yes.
She hears him enthusiastically talking about loyalty and essays, and she instantly starts calculating how to arrange a marriage between him and one of the daughters of the family. He represents stability.
He represents an influx of status and wealth. Up until now, we've been exploring Jiabayu's trap.
Right.
But his trap, as suffocating as it is largely psychological and professional. He is being pressured into a career he despises. He has the privilege of experiencing this as an existential crisis from the comfort of his study.
The comfort of a very nice, albeit stressful, room.
But for the women residing in this household, the trap is not philosophical. It is entirely literal. It is physical. We must shift our lens from the male burden of bureaucratic success to the female burden of total subjugation.
Because if Baoyu fails to conform, he is a disappointment. Maybe he brings financial ruin to the family down the line. But if the women fail to conform, their bodies and legal rights are immediately forfeit.
If I don't have the luxury of sitting around being melancholic.
No. And that disparity is what drives another member of the family, Xichun, to take incredibly extreme, seemingly violent measures to protect herself.
Xichun has observed the reality of the societal machinery, and she has realized that the game is irrevocably rigged against her.
So she initiates a drastic withdrawal. The text tells us she's refusing to eat, and most significantly, she is obsessively attempting to cut off her own hair to become a nun.
For a modern listener, cutting your hair might seem like a dramatic, edgy phase. But in the context of Qing Dynasty aristocracy, what does taking a blade to your hair actually signify?
It's a huge deal.
It is a severe, almost militant act of severing oneself from the social fabric. In traditional Confucian doctrine, there is a core tenet body, hair, and skin are received from parents. One dare not injure them.
So you don't even own your own hair.
Yeah.
Right. This is the beginning of filial piety. To intentionally cut your hair is to violently reject your parents' ownership over you. It is a visual, undeniable declaration that you are terminating your earthly ties and your social obligations.
She is essentially declaring bankruptcy on her family duties.
Yes.
And the family, trapped in their own paradigm, just assumes she's having a moody adolescent tantrum. But then, two nuns from the outside world, from the Dizhang Temple, come to visit the compound.
And the contrast in how the women of the house treat these nuns is incredibly revealing.
It really is. It's a masterclass in character positioning. We have Baoyu's wife, Bao Chai.
Now, Bao Chai is the absolute poster child for conforming to societal expectations.
She is proper. She is disciplined. She manages the household efficiently.
And she treats these visiting nuns with cold, dismissive disgust. She barely acknowledges their presence because, to her, they represent a failure to perform normal female duties.
But Xichun, on the other hand, eagerly engages with them. She is starving for intelligence from the outside world.
She needs to know how they got out.
Exactly. The conversation that unfolds between Xichun and these nuns is one of the darkest, most unflinching examinations of female agency I've ever encountered in literature.
Oh, it is brutal.
They start by discussing another nun, a woman named Miaoyu.
The story of Miaoyu is introduced as a cautionary tale. The nuns report that Miaoyu was violently kidnapped by bandits, and they argue, rather clinically, that Miaoyu's eccentricities, her beautiful poetry, her high-minded talent, none of those internal virtues provided any physical protection against the brutal reality of the world.
And then one of the visiting nuns delivers this incredibly bleak, terrifyingly lucid monologue about the reality of being born a woman. She doesn't sugarcoat it.
No, she lays it all out.
She states that to be born female is to be born into a life of, quote, unspoken grievances. She explicitly breaks down the mechanics of marriage.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, she's explaining the absolute lack of legal and property rights for women in this era.
She explains that once a woman is married off, her life is permanently, legally out of her control. Her entire fate, her physical safety, her standard of living, it is all completely tied to the whims of her husband, her mother-in-law, the political ties of his family, and the economic stability of his household.
She becomes a passenger locked in the cargo hold of a ship she cannot steer.
That is exactly it.
A daughter was a temporary resident in her father's house and a permanent subordinate in her husband's house. She could be married off to a stranger, potentially forced to live alongside concubines, completely subject to the authority of her husband's family.
It's just terrifying.
The nun concludes that the only actual escape hatch from this cycle of subjugation is devotion to Guanyin, the bodhisattva of compassion. She argues that religion is the only safe harbor because it fundamentally removes a woman from the perilous, violent market of marriage.
And Xichun hears this, and she is completely, entirely validated. This is the confirmation she has been waiting for.
She finds her out.
She declares right then and there that she is not someone who will willingly linger in a fire pit.
A fire pit. Let's examine that metaphor because it is explosive.
It really is. the socially acceptable, highly desired path of aristocratic marriage, the exact path that Lady Wang is trying to secure for the doppelganger, the path that Bao Chai has successfully navigated.
Xicheng looks at that entire institution and calls it a fire pit.
She sees the flames, and she threatens her sister-in-law, Yuxi, saying, "I will die before I am forced into marriage." She says she will starve herself to death.
And then she reveals her master plan.
Yes. She proposes moving into the family's empty Longkhui temple, located right there on the estate grounds, to live permanently as an ascetic nun.
It is a radical declaration of independence, but it is framed entirely within the only socially permissible vehicle for female autonomy religion.
Because looking at it, this feels less like a spiritual awakening and more like a brilliant legal loophole.
You are exactly right to look at the mechanics. It is a mix of legal, economic, and social immunity. When a person officially entered a monastic order in the Qing dynasty, they were conceptually and legally removed from the secular registry.
Meaning what, exactly?
They ceased to exist as taxable entities, and crucially, they ceased to exist as marriageable assets. By taking vows, Xicheng is legally dying to the patriarchy. The family cannot arrange a marriage for a woman who technically no longer exists in the secular world.
She is hacking the system. She realizes that if she becomes a nun but stays on family property in the Longkhui Temple, she executes the perfect tactical retreat.
It's brilliant.
She completely removes herself from the terrifying marriage market where she would be treated like a piece of property, but she maintains the physical protection and the basic resources of the Jia family compound. It's a genius move for survival.
But the tragedy of her hack is that her survival requires the complete annihilation of her social self.
She's given up everything.
Yes. She has to give up her youth, her potential for romantic love, her luxurious lifestyle, and her hair just to secure basic bodily autonomy. And when you contrast her with Bao Chai, the depth of Xicheng's terror becomes even more apparent.
Right. Bao Chai played the game perfectly. She married Bao Yu. She has status. She is the ideal Confucian wife.
Yes. But Xicheng looks at Bao Chai's success. She looks at the reality of being a wife in a chaotic, financially crumbling household, tasked with managing an unstable husband and endless familial politics, and Xicheng views that peak societal success as a fire pit.
She would rather starve, shave her head, and live in isolation than become Bao Chai.
Exactly.
But let me play devil's advocate for the family's perspective here, because they do not see Xicheng as a brilliant tactician. Her sister-in-law, Yuxi, completely dismisses her.
Completely.
Yuxi essentially waves her hand and says, oh, Xicheng is just acting out because her older brother, Jia Zhen, isn't home to supervise her. She's just throwing a tantrum.
She's so condescending.
Isn't there an argument that Xicheng is just running away from her responsibilities? She is refusing to take on the adult burdens of her gender and using religion as a shield?
The reaction from Yuxi is precisely what proves how dangerous and radical Xicheng's choice is to the established order. The family literally cannot comprehend the young woman actually, voluntarily desiring independence from the patriarchal structure.
It breaks their brains.
Their ideological paradigm is so rigid, so deeply entrenched, that the idea of a woman rejecting marriage and wealth is impossible for them to process as a rational choice. Therefore, it must be a pathology. It must be a tantrum caused by the absence of a male authority figure.
They invalidate her profound existential terror by treating it as a childish rebellion.
And this realization brings the narrative tension right back to our protagonist, Jia Baoyu.
Because he's still trapped.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Xicheng has found her legal exit through the monastery. But Baoyu does not have a temple to retreat to. The external pressures are closing in, his cosmic twin has betrayed him, and his mind simply cannot process the cognitive dissonance anymore. His exit is purely biological. His system shuts down.
We are moving into the collapse. The terrifying consequences of the shattered illusion. After the disastrous meeting with his sellout doppelganger, Baoyu returns to his room. He is deeply, clinically depressed.
He's broken.
He is sitting there, utterly devastated by the realization that his soulmate is a career worm. And in this moment of extreme vulnerability, he needs comfort. He needs his wife, Bao Chai, to be his sanctuary.
He needs her to say, I see you. It's okay. You don't have to be like him.
But instead, she looks at her devastated husband and tells him that a real man should care about making a name for himself. She essentially says, Zhen Baoyu is right. You are wrong. Grow up and get to work writing those essays.
We must understand Bao Chai's psychological position here because she is the pragmatic wife. As we discussed, her entire existence, her physical and legal survival, is inextricably tied to Baoyu's potential success in the bureaucracy.
Right. If he fails, she goes down with him. And that lecture breaks him. His father demands conformity with threats of violence. His cosmic twin demands conformity with bureaucratic platitudes. And now the person sharing his bed, his own wife, demands conformity with lectures.
There's no safe harbor left.
So Baoyu slips into a stupor. He reverts to a terrifying illness he has experienced in the past, where he completely loses touch with reality. He stops speaking, his eyes glaze over, he stops responding to stimuli, and crucially, just like Sichun, he stops eating.
It is so grim.
The family realizes this isn't just melancholy, he is actively dying. They start preparing his burial clothes.
It is the physical, biological manifestation of his spiritual starvation. He is literally starving to death in a sprawling estate filled with career worms because there is absolutely no nourishment left for his soul.
So the scene in the compound is utter chaos. The mourning period has ended, which ironically means their social obligations and expenses are piling up exponentially. They are incredibly short on cash, there are other relatives falling sick, and the golden boy, the sole heir of the household, is dying in his bed.
And suddenly, crashing into this gritty economic nightmare, the narrative introduces a surge of magical realism.
A massive, coarse, aggressive monk barges into the compound.
The intersection of the spiritual realm and the desperate material reality of the Jia family is a hallmark of the novel's brilliance.
This monk claims to have Baoyu's magical jade, a mystical inscribed rock that Baoyu was supposedly born with in his mouth, which he had lost earlier in the massive narrative.
Right.
The monk holds up this rock and says, "I have the cure for the boy." But he doesn't just hand it over out of holy benevolence. He demands an extortionate ransom. He looks at this grieving, panicking family and demands 10,000 taels of silver.
To truly grasp the audacity of this demand, we have to break down the silver economy of the Qing dynasty.
Please do, because it sounds like a lot, but I have no context for what that actually buys.
A prosperous middle-class family could live quite comfortably for an entire year on perhaps 20 or 30 taels of silver.
Wait, 20 or 30 for a whole year?
Yes. 10,000 taels is an astronomical, staggering fortune. It is the kind of money that builds palaces. It is an estate liquidating sum.
Jia Lian, the cousin who is actually responsible for managing the household's ledgers, absolutely panics. He knows the reality of their bank accounts. He knows the estate is practically bankrupt. He's like, "We cannot pay this. It's impossible."
But Jia Zhang, the strict father who earlier demanded essays, is now desperate.
His heir is fading away.
So breaking under the pressure, Jia Zhang agrees to pay the ransom.
And once the financial transaction is verbally secured, the monk performs the miracle. He walks up to the dying Baoyu, leans in, and yells directly into his ear, "Baoyu, your jade has returned."
And it works.
Baoyu's eyes snap open. He wakes up from the stupor. He takes the jade, greets it like an old friend, saying, "Long time no see," and almost immediately his physical strength returns. He is able to sit up and eat a bowl of congee. The biological crisis is averted.
It is a profound miracle. But it is a purchased miracle.
And that is exactly what I want to zero in on, the bizarre, highly transactional nature of this salvation.
It highlights the ultimate devastating irony of the Jia family's entire existence. They have sacrificed their morals, their peace of mind, and their children's souls in a relentless pursuit to accumulate wealth, rank, and status.
And in the end, they are forced to liquidate all of that accumulated wealth just to buy back a magical rock to keep their son's lungs expanding. The magic rock is back in Baoyu's hand. The boy is eating his congee. The family is breathing a massive sigh of relief. The immediate crisis is over.
But this brings us to the most crucial, devastating question of the entire narrative.
Right. Can a physical object, even a deeply magical one, actually cure a philosophical and psychological crisis?
The answer, which the text delivers with brutal efficiency in its final moments, is a resounding no. The fragility of this purchased cure is exposed almost instantaneously.
Right. So we're in the immediate aftermath of the miracle. Down the hall, Jia Zhang and Lady Wang are frantically trying to figure out how to sell off property and liquidate assets to pay this extortionist monk his 10,000 taels.
It's a scramble.
But in the bedroom, things seem calm. Baoyu is recovering. A maid named Sheyu, who has been faithfully taking care of him during his illness, is gently helping him sit up. She is overjoyed that the nightmare is over.
The atmosphere in the room is one of profound, exhausted relief. The tension is broken.
But then Sheyu carelessly makes a remark. She looks at the magical jade resting on Baoyu and she says, It's a real treasure. You just looked at it and got better. It's a good thing you didn't smash it back then.
It's a good thing you didn't smash it.
Instantly, Bayou's entire demeanor shifts. The color completely drains from his face. He takes the magical jade, throws it aside, falls backward onto the bed, and completely loses consciousness all over again.
And the text ends on this massive, brutal cliffhanger. The final words of the chapter are, "Unknown if dead or alive."
It is a breathtaking narrative whiplash, a complete reversal of the miracle in a matter of seconds.